suddenly stopped when the manager stepped forward, silenced the orchestra, and announced, "Mobilization has been ordered. It begins at midnight. Play the Marseillaise." In town, the streets were already emptied of vehicles requisitioned by the War Office. Groups of reservists with bundles and farewell bouquets of flowers were marching off to the Gare de l'Est as civilians waved and cheered. One group stopped to lay its flowers at the feet of the black-draped statue of Strasbourg in the Place de la Concorde. The crowds wept and cried, "Vive l'Alsace!" and tore off the mourning she had worn since 1870. Orchestras in restaurants played the French, Russian, and British anthems. "To think these are all being played by Hungarians," someone remarked. The playing of their anthem, as if to express a hope, made Englishmen in the crowd uncomfortable, and none more so than Sir Francis Bertie, the pink and plump British ambassador, who in a grey frock coat and grey top hat, holding a green parasol against the sun, was seen entering the Quai d'Orsay. Sir Francis felt sick at heart and ashamed. He ordered the gates of his embassy closed, for, as he wrote in his diary, "though it is vive l'Angleterre today, it may be perfide Albion tomorrow." In London, that thought hung heavily in the room where small, white-bearded Monsieur Cambon confronted Sir Edward Grey. When Grey said to him that some new development must be awaited because the dispute between Russia, Austria, and Germany concerned a matter of no interest to Great Britain, Cambon let a glint of anger penetrate his impeccable tact and polished dignity. Was England going to wait until French territory was invaded before intervening, he asked, and suggested that if so, her help might be very belated. Grey, behind his tight mouth and Roman nose, was in equal anguish. He believed fervently that England's interests required her to support France. He was prepared, in fact, to resign if she did not. He believed events to come would force her hand, but as yet he could say nothing officially to Cambon. Nor had he the knack of expressing himself unofficially. His manner, which the English public, seeing in him the image of the strong, silent man, found comforting, his foreign colleagues found icy. He managed only to express edgily the thought that was in everyone's mind that Belgian neutrality might become a factor. That was the development Grey, and not he alone, was waiting for. Britain's predicament resulted from a split personality evident both within the cabinet and between the parties. The cabinet was divided in a split that derived from the Boer War between liberal imperialists, represented by Asquith, Grey, Haldane, and Churchill, and Little Englanders, represented by all the rest. Heirs of Gladstone, they, like their late leader, harboured a deep suspicion of foreign entanglements and considered the aiding of oppressed peoples to be the only proper concern of foreign affairs, which were otherwise regarded as a tiresome interference with reform, free trade, home rule, and the Lord's veto. They tended to regard France as the decadent and frivolous grasshopper, and would have liked to regard Germany as the industrious, respectable ant, had not the posturings and roarings of the Kaiser and the pan-German militarists somehow discouraged this view. They would never have supported a war on behalf of France, although the injection of Belgium, a little country with a just call on British protection, might alter the issue. Grey's group in the cabinet, on the other hand, shared with the Tories a fundamental premise that Britain's national interest was bound up with the preservation of France. The reasoning was best expressed in the marvellously flat words of Grey himself. "If Germany dominated the continent, it would be disagreeable to us as well as to others, for we should be isolated." In this epic sentence is all of British policy, and from it followed the knowledge that, if the challenge were flung, England would have to fight to prevent that disagreeable outcome. But Grey could not say so without provoking a split in the cabinet and in the country that would be fatal to any war effort before it began. Alone in Europe, Britain had no conscription. In war, she would be dependent on voluntary enlistment. A secession from the government over the war issue would mean the formation of an anti-war party led by the dissidents, with disastrous effect on recruiting. If it was the prime objective of France to enter war with Britain as an ally, it was a prime necessity for Britain to enter war with a united government. This was the touchstone of the problem. In cabinet meetings, the group opposed to intervention proved strong. Their leader, Lord Morley, Gladstone's old friend and biographer, believed he could count on 8 or 9 likely to agree with us, against the solution being openly worked for by Churchill with demonic energy and Grey with strenuous simplicity. From discussions in the cabinet, it was clear to Morley that the neutrality of Belgium was secondary to the question of our neutrality in the struggle between Germany and France. It was equally clear to Grey that only violation of Belgium's neutrality would convince the peace party of the German menace and the need to go to war in the national interest. On August 1, the crack was visible and widening in cabinet and parliament. That day, 12 out of 18 cabinet members declared themselves opposed to giving France the assurance of Britain's support in war. That afternoon, in the lobby of the House of Commons, a caucus of Liberal MPs voted 19-4, though with many abstentions, for a motion that England should remain neutral, whatever happened in Belgium or elsewhere. That week, Punch published lines designed to represent the views of an average British patriot. "Why should I follow your fighting line for a matter that's no concern of mine? I shall be asked to a general scrap all over the European map, dragged into somebody else's war, for that's what a double entente is for." The average patriot had already used up his normal supply of excitement and indignation in the current Irish crisis. The Curragh Mutiny was England's Madame Caillaux. As a result of the Home Rule Bill, Ulster was threatening armed rebellion against autonomy for Ireland, and English troops stationed at the Curragh had refused to take up arms against Ulster loyalists. General Gough, the Curragh commander, had resigned with all his officers, whereupon Sir John French, chief of general staff, resigned, whereupon Colonel John Seeley, Haldane's successor as Secretary of War, resigned. The army seethed, uproar and schism ruled the country, and a palace conference of party leaders with the King met in vain. Lloyd George talked ominously of the gravest issue raised in this country since the days of the Stuarts. The words civil war and rebellion were mentioned. And a German arms firm hopefully ran a cargo of 40,000 rifles and 1 million cartridges into Ulster. In the meantime, there was no Secretary of War, the office being left to Prime Minister Asquith, who had little time and less inclination for it. Asquith had, however, a particularly active First Lord of the Admiralty. When he smelled battle afar off, Winston Churchill resembled the war horse in Job, who turned not back from the sword, but paweth in the valley and saith among the trumpets, "Ha, ha!" He was the only British minister to have a perfectly clear conviction of what Britain should do and to act upon it without hesitation. On July 26, the day Austria rejected Serbia's reply, and 10 days before his own government made up its mind, Churchill issued a crucial order. On July 26, the British fleet was completing, unconnected with the crisis, a test mobilisation and manoeuvres with full crews at war strength. At 7 o'clock next morning, the squadrons were due to disperse, some to various exercises on the high seas, some to home ports, where parts of their crews would be discharged back into training schools, some to dock for repairs. That Sunday, July 26, the First Lord remembered later, was a very beautiful day. When he learned the news from Austria, he made up his mind to make sure that the diplomatic situation did not get ahead of the naval situation, and that the Grand Fleet should be in its war station before Germany could know whether or not we should be in the war, and therefore, if possible, before we had decided ourselves. The italics are his own. After consultation with the First Sea Lord, Prince Louis of Battenberg, he gave orders to the fleet not to disperse. He then informed Grey what he had done, and with Grey's assent, released the Admiralty order to the newspapers, in the hope that the news might have a sobering effect on Berlin and Vienna. Holding the fleet together was not enough. It must be got, as Churchill expressed it, in capitals, to its war station. The primary duty of a fleet, as Admiral Mahan, the Clausewitz of naval warfare, had decreed, was to remain a fleet in being. In the event of war, the British fleet, upon which an island nation depended for its life, had to establish and maintain mastery of the ocean trade routes. It had to protect the British Isles from invasion. It had to protect the Channel and the French coasts in fulfilment of the pact with France. It had to keep concentrated in sufficient strength to win any engagement if the German fleet sought battle. And above all, it had to guard itself against that new and menacing weapon of unknown potential, the torpedo. The fear of a sudden undeclared torpedo attack haunted the Admiralty. On July 28, Churchill gave orders for the fleet to sail to its war base at Scapa Flow, far to the north at the tip of mist-shrouded Orkney in the North Sea. It steamed out of Portland on the 29th, and by nightfall, 18 miles of warships had passed northward through the Straits of Dover, headed not so much for some rendezvous with glory as for a rendezvous with discretion. "A surprise torpedo attack," wrote the First Lord, "was at any rate one nightmare gone forever." Having prepared the fleet for action, Churchill turned his abounding energy and sense of urgency upon preparing the country. He persuaded Asquith on July 29 to authorize the warning telegram, which was the arranged signal sent by the War Office and Admiralty to initiate the precautionary period. While short of the Kriegsgefahr, or the French state of siege, which established martial law, the precautionary period has been described as a device invented by a genius which permitted certain measures to be taken on the ipse dixit of the Secretary of War without reference to the Cabinet, when time was the only thing that mattered. Time pressed on the restless Churchill, who, expecting the Liberal government to break apart, went off to make overtures to his old party, the Tories. Coalition was not in the least to the taste of the Prime Minister, who was bent on keeping his government united. Lord Morley, at 76, was expected by no one to stay with the government in the event of war. Not Morley, but the far more vigorous Chancellor of the Exchequer, Lloyd George, was the key figure whom the government could not afford to lose, both for his proved ability in office and his influence upon the electorate. Shrewd, ambitious, and possessed of a spellbinding Welsh eloquence, Lloyd George leaned to the peace group, but might jump either way. He'd suffered recent setbacks in public popularity. He saw a new rival for party leadership arising in the individual whom Lord Morley called that splendid condottiere at the Admiralty. And he might, some of his colleagues thought, see political advantage in playing the peace card against Churchill. He was altogether an uncertain and dangerous quantity. Asquith, who had no intention of leading a divided country into war, continued to wait with exasperating patience for events which might convince the peace group. The question of the hour, he recorded in his passionless way in his diary for July 31, was, "Are we to go in or stand aside? Of course everybody longs to stand aside." In a less passive attitude, Grey, during the cabinet of July 31, almost reached the point blank. He said Germany's policy was that of a European aggressor as bad as Napoleon, a name that for England had only one meaning, and told the Cabinet that the time had come when a decision whether to support the Entente or preserve neutrality could no longer be deferred. He said that if it chose neutrality, he was not the man to carry out such a policy. His implied threat to resign echoed as if it had been spoken. "The Cabinet seemed to heave a sort of sigh," wrote one of them, and sat for several moments in breathless silence. Its members looked at one another, suddenly realizing that their continued existence as a government was now in doubt. They adjourned without reaching a decision. That Friday, eve of the August bank holiday weekend, the Stock Exchange closed down at 10 a.m. in a wave of financial panic that had started in New York when Austria declared war on Serbia, in which was closing exchanges all over Europe. The city trembled, prophesying doom and the collapse of foreign exchange. Bankers and businessmen, according to Lloyd George, were aghast at the idea of war which would break down the whole system of credit with London at its centre. The Governor of the Bank of England called on Saturday to inform Lloyd George that the city was totally opposed to our intervening in a war. That same Friday, the Tory leaders were being rounded up and called back to London from country houses to confer on the crisis. Dashing from one to the other, pleading, exhorting, expounding Britain's shame if the shilly-shallying Liberals held back now, was Henry Wilson, the heart, soul, spirit, backbone and legs of the Anglo-French military conversations. The agreed euphemism for the joint plans of the general staffs was conversations. The formula of no commitment, which Haldane had first established, which had raised misgivings in Campbell Bannerman, which Lord Esher had rejected, and which Grey had embodied in the 1912 letter to Cambon, still represented the official position, even if it did not make sense. It made very little. If, as Clausewitz justly said, war is a continuation of national policy, so also are war plans. The Anglo-French war plans, worked out in detail over a period of 9 years, were not a game or an exercise in fantasy or a paper practice to keep military minds out of other mischief. They were a continuation of policy or they were nothing. They were no different from France's arrangements with Russia or Germany's with Austria, except for the final legal fiction that they did not commit Britain to action. Members of the government and parliament who disliked the policy simply shut their eyes and mesmerized themselves into believing the fiction. Monsieur Cambon, visiting opposition leaders after his painful interview with Grey, now dropped diplomatic tact altogether. All our plans are arranged in common. Our general staffs have consulted. You have seen all our schemes and preparations. Look at our fleet. Our whole fleet is in the Mediterranean in consequence of our arrangements with you, and our coasts are open to the enemy. You have laid us wide open. He told them that if England did not come in, France would never forgive her, and ended with a bitter cry, Quel honneur! Est-ce que l'Angleterre comprend ce que c'est l'honneur? And honour, does England understand what honour is? Honour wears different coats to different eyes, and Grey knew it would have to wear a Belgian coat before the peace group could be persuaded to see it. That same afternoon he dispatched 2 telegrams, asking the French and German governments for a formal assurance that they were prepared to respect Belgian neutrality so long as no other power violates it. Within an hour of receiving the telegram in the late evening of July 31, France replied in the affirmative. No reply was received from Germany. Next day, August 1, the matter was put before the cabinet. Lloyd George traced with his finger on a map what he thought would be the German route through Belgium, just across the near corner on the shortest straight line to Paris. It would only, he said, be a little violation. When Churchill asked for authority to mobilize the fleet, that is, call up all the naval reserves, the cabinet, after a sharp discussion, refused. When Grey asked for authority to implement the promises made to the French Navy, Lord Morley, John Burns, Sir John Simon and Lewis Harcourt proposed to resign. Outside the cabinet, rumours were swirling of the last-minute wrestlings of Kaiser and Tsar and of the German ultimatums. Grey left the room to speak to, and be misunderstood by Lichnowsky on the telephone, and unwittingly to be the cause of havoc in the heart of General Moltke. He also saw Cambon and told him, France must take her own decision at this moment without reckoning on an assistance we are not now in a position to give. He returned to the cabinet while Cambon, white and shaking, sank into a chair in the room of his old friend Sir Arthur Nicholson, the permanent undersecretary. Ils vont nous lâcher. They're going to desert us, he said. To the editor of the Times, who asked him what he was going to do, he replied, I am going to wait to learn if the word honour should be erased from the English dictionary. In the cabinet, no one wanted to burn his bridges. Resignations were bruited, not yet offered. Asquith continued to sit tight, say little and await developments, as that day of crossed wires and complicated frenzy drew to a close. That evening, Moltke was refusing to go east. Lieutenant Feldman's company was seizing Trois Vierges in Luxembourg. Messimi, over the telephone, was reconfirming the 10-kilometre withdrawal. And at the Admiralty, the First Lord was entertaining friends from the opposition, among them the future Lords Beaverbrook and Birkenhead. To keep occupied while waiting out the tension, they played bridge after dinner. During the game, a messenger brought in a red dispatch box. It happened to be one of the largest size. Taking a key from his pocket, Churchill opened it, took out the single sheet of paper it contained, and read the single line on the paper. Germany has declared war on Russia. He informed the company, changed out of his dinner jacket, and went straight out like a man going to a well-accustomed job. Churchill walked across the Horse Guards parade to Downing Street, entered by the garden gate, and found the Prime Minister upstairs with Grey, Haldane, now Lord Chancellor, and Lord Crewe, Secretary for India. He told them he intended instantly to mobilise the fleet, notwithstanding the cabinet decision. Asquith said nothing, but appeared, Churchill thought, quite content. Grey, accompanying Churchill on his way out, said to him, "I've just done a very important thing. I've told Cambon that we shall not allow the German fleet to come into the Channel." Or that is what Churchill, experiencing the perils of verbal intercourse with Grey, understood him to say. It meant that the fleet was now committed. Whether Grey said he had given the promise, or whether he said, as scholars have since decided, that he was going to give it the next day, is not really relevant, for whichever it was, it merely confirmed Churchill in a decision already taken. He returned to the Admiralty and gave forthwith the order to mobilise. Both his order and Grey's promise to make good the naval agreement with France were contrary to majority cabinet sentiment. On the next day, the cabinet would have to ratify these acts or break apart, and by that time Grey expected a development to come out of Belgium. Like the French, he felt that he could count on Germany to provide it. Chapter 8. Ultimatum in Brussels. Locked in the safe of Herr von Below-Saleske, German minister in Brussels, was a sealed envelope brought to him by special courier from Berlin on July 29, with orders not to open until you are instructed by telegraph from here. On Sunday, August 2, Baylor was advised by telegram to open the envelope at once and deliver the note it contained by 8 o'clock that evening, taking care to give the Belgian government the impression that all the instructions relating to this affair reached you for the first time today. He was to demand a reply from the Belgians within 12 hours and wire it to Berlin as quickly as possible, and also forward it immediately by automobile to General von Emmich at the Union Hotel in Aachen. Aachen, or Aix-la-Chapelle, was the nearest German city to Liège, the eastern gateway to Belgium. Herr von Below, a tall, erect bachelor with pointed black moustaches and a jade cigarette holder in constant use, had taken up his post in Belgium early in 1914. When visitors to the German legation asked him about a silver ashtray pierced by a bullet hole that lay on his desk, he would laugh and reply, "I am a bird of ill omen. When I was stationed in Turkey, they had a revolution. When I was in China, it was the Boxers. One of their shots through the window made that bullet hole." He would raise his cigarette delicately to his lips with a wide and elegant gesture and add, "But now I am resting. Nothing ever happens in Brussels." Since the sealed envelope arrived, he had been resting no longer. At noon on August 1, he received a visit from Baron de Bassompierre, Under-Secretary of the Belgian Foreign Office, who told him the evening papers intended to publish France's reply to Grey, in which she promised to respect Belgian neutrality. Bassompierre suggested that in the absence of a comparable German reply, Herr von Below might wish to make a statement. Below was without authority from Berlin to do so. Taking refuge in diplomatic manoeuvre, he lay back in his chair, and with his eyes fixed on the ceiling, repeated back word for word through a haze of cigarette smoke everything that Bassompierre had just said to him, as if playing back a record. Rising, he assured his visitor that Belgium had nothing to fear from Germany, and closed the interview. Next morning he repeated the assurance to Monsieur d'Avignon, the foreign minister, who had been awakened at 6 a.m. by news of the German invasion of Luxembourg, and had asked for an explanation. Back at the legation, Below soothed a clamouring press with a felicitous phrase that was widely quoted, "Your neighbour's roof may catch fire, but your own house will be safe." Many Belgians, official and otherwise, were disposed to believe him, some from pro-German sympathies, some from wishful thinking, and some from simple confidence in the good faith of the international guarantors of Belgium's neutrality. In 75 years of guaranteed independence, they'd known peace for the longest unbroken period in their history. The territory of Belgium had been the pathway of warriors since Caesar fought the Belgae. In Belgium, Charles the Bold of Burgundy and Louis XI of France had fought out their long and bitter rivalry. There Spain had ravaged the Low Countries. There Marlborough had fought the French at the very murderous Battle of Malplaquet. There Napoleon had met Wellington at Waterloo. There the people had risen against every ruler, Burgundian, French, Spanish, Habsburg or Dutch, until the final revolt against the House of Orange in 1830. Then, under Leopold of Saxe-Coburg, maternal uncle of Queen Victoria, as king, they had made themselves a nation, grown prosperous, spent their energies in fraternal fighting between Flemings and Walloons, Catholics and Protestants, and in disputes over socialism and French and Flemish bilingualism, in the fervent hope that their neighbours would leave them to continue undisturbed in this happy condition. The king and prime minister and chief of staff could no longer share the general confidence, but were prevented, both by the duties of neutrality and by their belief in neutrality, from making plans to repel attack. Up until the last moment, they could not bring themselves to believe an invasion by one of their guarantors would actually happen. On learning of the German Kriegsgefahr on July 31, they had ordered mobilization of the Belgian army to begin at midnight. During the night and next day, policemen went from house to house ringing doorbells and handing out orders, while men scrambled out of bed or left their jobs, wrapped up their bundles, said their farewells, and went off to their regimental depots. Because Belgium, maintaining her strict neutrality, had not up to now settled on any plan of campaign, mobilization was not directed against a particular enemy or oriented in a particular direction. It was a call-up without deployment. Belgium was obligated, as well as her guarantors, to preserve her own neutrality, and could make no overt act until one was made against her. When, by the evening of August 1, Germany's silence in response to Grey's request had continued for 24 hours, King Albert determined on a final private appeal to the Kaiser. He composed it in consultation with his wife, Queen Elizabeth, a German by birth, the daughter of a Bavarian duke, who translated it sentence by sentence into German, weighing with the king the choice of words and their shades of meaning. It recognized that political objections might stand in the way of a public statement, but hoped the bonds of kinship and friendship would decide the Kaiser to give King Albert his personal and private assurance of respect for Belgian neutrality. The kinship in question, which stemmed from King Albert's mother, Princess Maria of Hohenzollern-Sigmaringen, a distant and Catholic branch of the Prussian royal family, failed to move the Kaiser to reply. Instead came the ultimatum that had been waiting in Herr von Below's safe for the last 4 days. It was delivered at 7 on the evening of August 2, when a footman at the Foreign Office pushed his head through the door of the Undersecretary's room and reported in an excited whisper, "The German minister has just gone in to see Monsieur d'Avignon." 15 minutes later, Below is seen driving back down the Rue de la Loi, holding his hat in his hands, beads of perspiration on his forehead, and smoking with the rapid, jerky movements of a mechanical toy. The instant his haughty silhouette had been seen to leave the Foreign Office, the two under-secretaries rushed into the minister's room, where they found Monsieur d'Avignon, a man until now of immutable and tranquil optimism, looking extremely pale. "Bad news, bad news," he said, handing them the German note he had just received. Baron de Geffier, the political secretary, read it aloud, translating slowly as he went, while Bassompierre, sitting at the minister's desk, took it down, discussing each ambiguous phrase to make sure of the right rendering. While they worked, Monsieur d'Avignon and his permanent under-secretary, Baron von der Elst, listened, sitting in two chairs on either side of the fireplace. Monsieur d'Avignon's last word on any problem had always been, "I'm sure it will turn out all right," while von der Elst's esteem for the Germans had led him in the past to assure his government that rising German armaments were intended only for the Drang nach Osten to impress the East and portended no trouble for Belgium. Baron de Broqueville, premier and concurrently war minister, entered the room as the work concluded. A tall, dark gentleman of elegant grooming, whose resolute air was enhanced by an energetic black moustache and expressive black eyes. As the ultimatum was read to him, everyone in the room listened to each word with the same intensity that the authors had put into the drafting. It had been drawn up with great care, with perhaps a subconscious sense that it was to be one of the critical documents of the century. General Moltke had written the original version in his own hand on July 26, 2 days before Austria declared war on Serbia, 4 days before Austria and Russia mobilized, and on the same day when Germany and Austria had rejected Sir Edward Grey's proposal for a five-power conference. Moltke had sent his draft to the Foreign Office, where it was revised by Under-Secretary Zimmermann and Political Secretary Stumm, further corrected and modified by Foreign Minister Jagow and Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg, before the final draft was sent in the sealed envelope to Brussels on the 29th. The extreme pains the Germans took reflected the importance they attached to the document. Germany had received reliable information, the note began, of a proposed advance by the French along the route Givet-Namur, leaving no doubt of France's intention to advance against Germany through Belgian territory. As the Belgians had seen no evidence of French movement toward Namur for the excellent reason that there was none, the charge failed to impress them. Germany, the note continued, being unable to count on the Belgian army halting the French advance, was required by the dictate of self-preservation to anticipate this hostile attack. She would view it with deepest regret if Belgium should regard her entrance on Belgian soil as an act of hostility against herself. If Belgium should, on the other hand, adopt a benevolent neutrality, Germany would bind herself to evacuate her territory as soon as peace shall have been concluded, to pay for any damages caused by German troops, and to guarantee at the conclusion of peace the sovereign rights and independence of the kingdom. In the original, the sentence had continued, and to favour with the greatest goodwill any possible claims of Belgium for compensation at the expense of France. At the last moment, Bailo was instructed to delete this bribe. If Belgium opposed Germany's passage through her territory, the note concluded, she would be regarded as an enemy, and future relations with her would be left to the decision of arms. An unequivocal answer was demanded within 12 hours. A long, tragic silence of several minutes followed the reading. Bassompierre recalled, as each man in the room thought of the choice that faced his country. Small in size and young in independence, Belgium clung more fiercely to independence for that reason. But no one in the room needed to be told what the consequences of a decision to defend it would be. Their country would be subjected to attack, their homes to destruction, their people to reprisals by a force 10 times their size, with no doubt of the outcome to themselves, who were in the immediate pathway of the Germans, whatever the ultimate outcome of the war. If, on the contrary, they were to yield to the German demand, they would be making Belgium an accessory to the attack on France, as well as a violator of her own neutrality, besides opening her to German occupation with small likelihood that a victorious Germany would remember to withdraw. They would be occupied either way. To yield would be to lose honour too. If we are to be crushed, Bassompierre recorded their sentiment, let us be crushed gloriously. In 1914, glory was a word spoken without embarrassment, and honour a familiar concept the people believed in. Von der Elst broke the silence in the room. "Well, sir, are we ready?" he asked the Premier. "Yes, we are ready," de Broqueville answered. "Yes," he repeated, as if trying to convince himself. "Except for one thing. We have not yet got our heavy artillery." Only in the last year had the government obtained increased military appropriations from a reluctant parliament conditioned to neutrality. The order for heavy guns had been given to the German firm of Krupp, which, not surprisingly, had delayed deliveries. 1 hour of the 12 had already gone by. While their colleagues began rounding up all ministers for a council of state to be held at 9 o'clock, Bassompierre and Geffier started working on a draft of the reply. They had no need to ask each other what it would be. Leaving the task to them, Premier de Broqueville went to the palace to inform the king. King Albert felt a responsibility as ruler that made his awareness of outside pressures acute. He had not been born to reign. A younger son of King Leopold's younger brother, he was left to grow up in a corner of the palace with a Swiss tutor of more than ordinary mediocrity. Coburg family life was not joyous. Leopold's own son died. In 1891, his nephew Baudouin Albert's older brother died, leaving Albert heir to the throne at 16. The old king, embittered by the loss of his own son and of Baudouin, to whom he had transferred his paternal affections, did not at first see much in Albert, whom he called a sealed envelope. Inside the envelope were enormous physical and intellectual energies of the kind that marked two great contemporaries, Theodore Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, whom otherwise Albert resembled not at all. He was reserved where they were extroverts, yet he shared many tastes, if not temperament, with Roosevelt, his love of the outdoors, of physical exercise, of riding and climbing, his interest in natural science and conservation, and his gluttony for books. Like Roosevelt, Albert consumed books at the rate of two a day on any and all subjects: literature, military science, colonialism, medicine, Judaism, aviation. He drove a motorbicycle and piloted a plane. His ultimate passion was mountaineering, which, incognito, he pursued all over Europe. As heir apparent, he toured Africa to study colonial problems at first hand. As king, he studied the army or the coal mines of the Borinage or the red country of the Walloons in the same way. "When he speaks, the king always looks as if he wished to build something," said one of his ministers. In 1900, he had married Elizabeth of Wittelsbach, whose father, the Duke, practiced as an oculist in the Munich hospitals. Their obvious affection for each other, their three children, their model family life, in contrast to the unseemly ways of the old regime, gave Albert a head start in popular approval when, in 1909, to general relief and rejoicing, he took the place of King Leopold II upon the throne. The new king and queen continued to ignore pomp, entertain whom they liked, exercise their curiosity and love of adventure where they liked, and remain indifferent to danger, etiquette, and criticism. They were not bourgeois so much as bohemian royalty. In military school, Albert had been a cadet at the same time as a future chief of staff, Émile Gallet. A shoemaker's son, Gallet had been sent to the school by popular subscription of his village. Later he became an instructor in the War College, and resigned when he could no longer agree with its dauntless theories of the offensive, which the Belgian staff, regardless of the difference in circumstance, had taken over from the French. Gallet had also left the Catholic Church to become a strict evangelical. Pessimistic, hypercritical, and dedicated, he was intensely serious about his profession as about everything else. It was said he read the Bible daily and was never known to laugh. The king heard him lecture, met him at manoeuvres, was impressed by his teachings that offensive for its own sake and under all circumstances was dangerous, that an army should seek battle only if there is prospect of important success, and that attack calls for superiority of means. Though still a captain, though a working man's son, though a convert to Protestantism in a Catholic country, he was chosen by King Albert as his personal military adviser, a post specially created for the purpose. Since, according to the Belgian constitution, King Albert would become commander-in-chief only after the outbreak of war, he and Gallet were unable in the meantime to impose their fears or their ideas of strategy upon the general staff. The staff clung to the example of 1870, when not a toe of either the Prussian or French armies had stepped over the Belgian border, although if the French had crossed into Belgian territory, they would have had room enough to retreat. King Albert and Gallet, however, believed that the huge growth of armies since that time made it clearer each year that if the nations marched again, they would spill over onto the old pathways and meet again in the old arena. The Kaiser had made this perfectly clear in the interview which so stunned Leopold II in 1904. After his return, Leopold's shock gradually wore off, for as von der Elst, to whom the king reported the interview, agreed, William was such a weathercock, how could one be sure? On a return visit to Brussels in 1910, the Kaiser proved indeed to be most reassuring. "Belgium had nothing to fear from Germany," he told von der Elst. "You will have no grounds of complaint against Germany. I understand perfectly your country's position. I shall never place her in a false position." On the whole, Belgians believed him. They took their guarantee of neutrality seriously. Belgium had neglected her army, frontier defences, fortresses, anything that implied lack of confidence in the protective treaty. Socialism was the raging issue. Public apathy to what was happening abroad, and a parliament obsessed by economy, allowed the army to deteriorate to a condition resembling the Turkish. Troops were ill-disciplined, slack, untidy, avoided saluting, slouched in the ranks, and refused to keep step. The officers' corps was little better. Because the army was considered superfluous and slightly absurd, it did not attract the best minds or young men of ability and ambition. Those who did make it a career and passed through the École de Guerre became infected with the French doctrine of élan and offensive à outrance. The remarkable formula they evolved was, to ensure against our being ignored, it was essential that we should attack. However magnificent the spirit, this formula conformed ill with the realities of Belgium's position, and the doctrine of the offensive sat oddly upon an army staff committed by the duty of neutrality to plan for the defensive only. Neutrality forbade them to plan in concert with any other nation, and required of them to regard the first foot put inside their territory as hostile, whether it was English, French, or German. Under the circumstances, a coherent plan of campaign was not easily achieved. The Belgian army consisted of 6 divisions of infantry, plus a cavalry division. These would have to face the 34 divisions, scheduled by the Germans to march through Belgium. Equipment and training were inadequate, and marksmanship inferior in view of army funds that permitted enough ammunition for only 2 firing practices of 1 round per man a week. Compulsory military service, not introduced until 1913, only served to make the army more unpopular than ever. In that year of ominous rumblings from abroad, Parliament reluctantly raised the annual contingent from 13,000 to 33,000. But agreed to appropriate funds for modernizing the defences of Antwerp, only on condition that the cost be absorbed by reducing the conscript period of service. No general staff existed until 1910, when the new king insisted upon creating one. Its effectiveness was limited by the extreme dissidence of its members. One school favoured an offensive plan with the army concentrated at the frontiers upon threat of war. Another school favoured the defensive, with the army concentrated in the interior. A third group, consisting chiefly of King Albert and Captain Gallet, favoured a defensive as close as possible to the threatened frontier, but without risking the lines of communication to the fortified base at Antwerp. While the European sky was darkening, Belgium's staff officers wrangled and failed to complete a plan of concentration. Their difficulty was compounded by their not permitting themselves to specify who the enemy would be. A compromise plan had been agreed on, but existed only in outline, without railroad timetables, supply depots, or billets. In November 1913, King Albert was invited to Berlin as his uncle had been 9 years before. The Kaiser gave him a royal dinner at a table covered with violets and set for 55 guests, among them Secretary of War General Falkenhayn, Secretary of the Imperial Navy Admiral Tirpitz, Chief of Staff General Moltke, and Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg. The Belgian ambassador, Baron Byens, who was also present, noticed that the king sat through dinner looking unusually grave. After dinner, Byens watched him in conversation with Moltke and saw Albert's face growing darker and more somber as he listened. On leaving, he said to Byens, "Come tomorrow at 9, I must talk to you." In the morning he walked with Byens through the Brandenburg Gate, past the rows of glaring white marble Hohenzollerns in heroic postures, mercifully shrouded by the morning mist, to the Tiergarten, where they could talk undisturbed. At a court ball, early in his visit, Albert said, he had received his first shock when the Kaiser pointed out to him a general, it was von Kluck, as the man designated to lead the march on Paris. Then, prior to dinner the evening before, the Kaiser, taking him aside for a personal talk, had poured forth a hysterical tirade against France. He said France never ceased provoking him. As a result of her attitude, war with France was not only inevitable, it was near at hand. The French press treated Germany with malice, the 3-year law was a deliberately hostile act, and all France was moved by an unquenchable thirst for revanche. Trying to stem the flow, Albert said he knew the French better. He visited France every year, and he could assure the Kaiser they were not aggressive but sincerely desired peace. In vain, the Kaiser kept insisting war was inevitable. After dinner, Moltke took up the refrain. War with France was coming. This time we must make an end of it. Your Majesty cannot imagine the irresistible enthusiasm which will permeate Germany on the day. The German army was invincible. Nothing could stand up to the furor Teutonicus. Terrible destruction would mark its path. Its victory could not be in doubt. Troubled by what motivated these startling confidences as much as by their content, Albert could only conclude they were intended to frighten Belgium into coming to terms. Evidently the Germans had made up their minds, and he felt that France should be warned. He instructed Bynes to repeat everything to Jules Cambon, the French ambassador in Berlin, and to charge him to report the matter to President Poincaré in the strongest terms. Later, they learned that Major Melotte, the Belgian military attaché, had been treated to an even more violent outburst by General Moltke at the same dinner. He also heard that war with France was inevitable and much nearer than you think. Moltke, who usually maintained great reserve with foreign attachés, on this occasion unbuttoned himself. He said Germany did not want war, but the general staff was arch-ready. He said France must absolutely stop provoking and annoying us, or we shall have to come to blows. The sooner the better. We've had enough of these continual alerts. As examples of French provocations, Moltke cited, apart from big things, a cold reception given in Paris to German aviators, and a boycott by Paris Society of Major Winterfeld, the German military attaché. The Major's mother, Countess Dolvensleben, had complained bitterly. As for England, well, the German navy was not built to hide in harbour. It would attack and probably be beaten. Germany would lose her ships, but England would lose mastery of the seas, which would pass to the United States, who would be the sole gainer from a European war. England knew this and, said the general, taking a sharp turn in his logic, would probably stay neutral. He was far from finished. What would Belgium do, he asked Major Melotte, if a large foreign force invaded her territory? Melotte replied that she would defend her neutrality. In an effort to find out whether Belgium would content herself with a protest, as the Germans believed, or would fight, Moltke pressed him to be more specific. When Melotte answered, "We will oppose with all our forces whatever power violates our frontiers," Moltke pointed out smoothly that good intentions were not enough. "You must also have an army capable of fulfilling the duty which neutrality imposes." Back in Brussels, King Albert called at once for a progress report on the mobilization plans. He found no progress had been made. On the basis of what he had heard in Berlin, he obtained de Broqueville's agreement for a plan of campaign based on the hypothesis of a German invasion. He got his own and Gallet's nominee, an energetic officer named Colonel de Reichel, appointed to carry out the work promised for April. By April, it was still not ready. Meanwhile, de Broqueville had appointed another officer, General de Cellier de Moranville, as chief of staff over de Reichel's head. In July, four separate plans of concentration were still being considered. Discouragement did not change the king's mind. His policy was embodied in a memorandum drawn up by Captain Gallet immediately after the Berlin visit. "We are resolved to declare war at once upon any power that deliberately violates our territory, to wage war with the utmost energy and with the whole of our military resources, wherever required, even beyond our frontiers, and to continue to wage war even after the invader retires until the conclusion of a general peace." On August 2, King Albert, presiding at the Council of State when it met at 9 p.m. in the palace, opened with the words, "Our answer must be no, whatever the consequences. Our duty is to defend our territorial integrity. In this we must not fail." He insisted, however, that no one present should allow himself any illusions. The consequences would be grave and terrible. The enemy would be ruthless. Premier de Broqueville warned waverers not to put faith in Germany's promise to restore Belgian integrity after the war. "If Germany is victorious," he said, Belgium, whatever her attitude, will be annexed to the German Empire. One aged and indignant minister, who had recently entertained as his house guest the Duke of Schleswig-Holstein, brother-in-law of the Kaiser, could not contain his wrath at the perfidy of the Duke's expressions of friendship, and kept up an angry mumbling as chorus to the proceedings. When General de Celliers, the Chief of Staff, rose to explain the strategy of defence to be adopted, his Deputy Chief Colonel de Reitel, with whom his relations were, in the words of a colleague, denuded of the amenities, kept growling between his teeth, "Il faut piquer dedans, il faut piquer dedans, we must hit them where it hurts." Given the floor, he amazed his hearers with a proposal to anticipate the invader by attacking him on his own territory before he could cross the Belgian frontier. At midnight, the meeting adjourned, while a committee of the Premier, Foreign Minister and Minister of Justice returned to the Foreign Office to draft a reply. While they were at work, a motor car drew up in the dark courtyard beneath the single row of lighted windows. A visit of the German minister was announced to the startled ministers. It was 1:30 a.m. What could he want at this hour? Herr von Below's nocturnal unrest reflected his government's growing uneasiness about the effect of their ultimatum, now irrevocably committed to paper and irrevocably working upon Belgian national pride. The Germans had been telling one another for years that Belgium would not fight, but now when the moment arrived they began to suffer an acute, if belated, anxiety. A valiant and ringing no from Belgium would peal round the world, with effect on the other neutral countries hardly beneficial to Germany. But Germany was not so worried about the attitude of neutral countries as she was about the delay that armed Belgian resistance would inflict upon her timetable. A Belgian army that chose to fight rather than line up along the road would require the leaving behind of divisions needed for the march on Paris. By destruction of railroads and bridges, it could disrupt the Germans' line of march and flow of supplies and cause an infinity of annoyance. Prior to second thoughts, the German government had sent Herr von Below in the middle of the night to try to influence the Belgian reply by further accusations against France. He informed van der Elst, who received him, that French dirigibles had dropped bombs and that French patrols had crossed the border. "Where did these events take place?" van der Elst asked. "In Germany," was the reply. "In that case, I fail to see the relevance of the information." The German minister offered to explain that the French lacked respect for international law and could therefore be expected to violate Belgian neutrality. This ingenious exercise in logic somehow fell short of making its point. Van der Elst showed his visit to the door. At 2:30 a.m. the council reconvened in the palace to approve the reply to Germany submitted by the ministers. It stated that the Belgian government would sacrifice the honour of the nation and betray its duty to Europe if it accepted the German proposals. It declared itself firmly resolved to repel by all means in its power every attack upon its rights. After approving the document without change, the council fell into dispute over the king's insistence that no appeal to the guarantor powers for assistance should be made until the Germans actually entered Belgium. Despite vigorous disagreement, he carried his point. At 4 a.m. the council broke up. The last minister to leave turned and saw King Albert standing with his back to the room and a copy of the reply in his hand, staring out of the window where the dawn was beginning to light the sky. In Berlin, too, a late meeting was being held that night of August 2. At the Chancellor's house, Bethmann Hollweg, General von Moltke, and Admiral Tirpitz were conferring about a declaration of war on France, as they had conferred the night before about Russia. Tirpitz complained again and again that he could not understand why these declarations of war were necessary. They always had an aggressive flavour. An army could march without such things. Bethmann pointed out that a declaration of war on France was necessary because Germany wanted to march through Belgium. Tirpitz repeated Ambassador Lichnowsky's warnings from London that an invasion of Belgium would bring England in. He suggested that the entry into Belgium might be delayed. Moltke, terrified by another threat to his schedule, at once declared this to be impossible. Nothing must be allowed to interfere with the machinery of transport. He did not himself, he said, attach much value to declarations of war. French hostile acts during the days had already made war a fact. He was referring to the alleged reports of French bombings in the Nuremberg area, which the German press had been blazing forth in extras all day, with such effect that people in Berlin went about looking nervously at the sky. In fact, no bombings had taken place. Now, according to German logic, a declaration of war was found to be necessary because of the imaginary bombings. Tirpitz still deplored it. There could be no doubt in the world, he said, that the French were at least intellectually the aggressors. But owing to the carelessness of German politicians in not making this clear to the world, the invasion of Belgium, which was a pure emergency measure, would be made to appear unfairly in the fateful light of a brutal act of violence. In Brussels, after the Council of State broke up at 4 a.m. on the morning of August 3, D'Avignon returned to the Foreign Office and instructed his political secretary, Baron de Geffier, to deliver Belgium's reply to the German minister. At precisely 7 a.m., the last moment of the 12 hours, Geffier rang the doorbell of the German legation and delivered the reply to Herr von Below. On his way home, he heard the cries of newsboys as the Monday morning papers announced the text of the ultimatum and the Belgian answer. He heard the sharp exclamations as people read the news and gathered in excited groups. Belgium's defiant no exhilarated the public. Many expressed the belief that it would cause the Germans to skirt their territory rather than risk universal censure. The Germans are dangerous, but they're not maniacs, people assured one another. Even in the palace and in the ministries, some hope persisted. It was hard to believe that the Germans would deliberately choose to start the war by putting themselves in the wrong. The last hope vanished when the Kaiser's belated reply to King Albert's personal appeal of 2 days before was received on the evening of August the 3rd. It was one more attempt to induce the Belgians to acquiesce without fighting. Only with the most friendly intentions toward Belgium, the Kaiser telegraphed, had he made his grave demand. As the conditions laid down make clear, the possibility of maintaining our former and present relations still lies in the hands of your Majesty. "What does he take me for?" King Albert exclaimed, in the first show of anger he'd allowed himself since the crisis began. Assuming the supreme command, he at once gave orders for the blowing up of the Meuse bridges at Liège and of the railroad tunnels and bridges at the Luxembourg frontier. He still postponed sending the appeal for military help and alliance to Britain and France. Belgian neutrality had been one collective act of the European powers that almost succeeded. King Albert could not bring himself to sign its death certificate until the overt act of invasion had actually taken place. Chapter 9. Home Before the Leaves Fall. On Sunday afternoon, August 2, a few hours before the German ultimatum was delivered in Brussels, Grey asked the British cabinet for authority to fulfil the naval engagement to defend the French Channel coast. No more distressing moment can ever face a British government than that which requires it to come to a hard and fast and specific decision. Through the long afternoon, the cabinet squirmed uncomfortably, unready and unwilling to grasp the handle of final commitment. In France, war came and was accepted as a kind of national fate, however deeply a part of the people would have preferred to avoid it. Almost in awe, a foreign observer reported the upsurge of national devotion, joined with an entire absence of excitement, in a people of whom it had so often been predicted that anarchical influences had undermined their patriotism and would prove fatal in the event of war. Belgium, where there occurred one of the rare appearances of the hero in history, was lifted above herself by the uncomplicated conscience of her king, and faced with the choice to acquiesce or resist, took less than 3 hours to make her decision, knowing it might be mortal. Britain had no Albert and no Alsace. Her weapons were ready, but not her will. Over the past 10 years, she'd studied and prepared for the war that was now upon her, and had developed, since 1905, a system called the War Book, which left nothing to the traditional British practice of muddling through. All orders to be issued in the event of war were ready for signature, envelopes were addressed, notices and proclamations were either printed or set up in type, and the king never moved from London without having with him those that required his immediate signature. The method was plain. The muddle was in the British mind. The appearance of a German fleet in the Channel would have been no less